I think we can get started. Does this sound like it's on to you? It does sound. I can't hear that if it sounds on or not. I don't know if some of you in the back would be able to close doors or something. I don't know what the procedure is here. Okay, my name is Phil Arendt, is how you pronounce it. I teach chemistry, physics, and physical science at Schaefer Academy up in Rochester, Minnesota. And I've been one who has been struggling over the years to teach my classes classically. And so I wanted to share some of the efforts that I've been put forth, hopefully they will be beneficial to some of you. But I wanted to show you that I have a blank piece of paper here and I have a pen because I hope to glean a little bit from all of your efforts as well. I think that that's one of the benefits of having a workshop of this nice size. It's kind of nice that George Grant is speaking now because that kind of weeds out a lot of the people here and those who are just really dedicated to science. Let me open our time in asking our Heavenly Father's blessing, and let me share some thoughts with you and put you on the spot maybe to glean some of the things that you're doing in class as well. Let's pray. Do lift up this time to you, Father. Ask that you would open our minds, open our hearts, be able to apply to the task that you've given us back in our schools at least a few things more to give you glory. And I thank you for this opportunity that I have. I ask for your help. In Jesus' name, amen. So when I say trivium efforts in chemistry, what I'd like to do is, I always find myself approaching things from different directions than most people do. I'm sorry about that. But I think sometimes if you hear different approaches, it helps stimulate things. So I'd like to first talk a little bit theoretically about the trivium, kind of a bent that I have in showing how the trivium is a wonderful fit to a perspective that of God's design of our soul. I've shared this with my colleagues at Schaefer, a little bit of it, as well as if anyone, last year in Atlanta, I spoke on the seven laws of teaching, and I tried to approach it from this angle as well. So again, this distinction of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, I'd like to approach through a perspective of our soul's design. What I mean by a perspective, there's so many perspectives out there. I just want to look at my students and get an idea of how they're wired and try to address them in the way that they deliberate. So let me take you on a little history of my own personal struggles. In 1988, I was on a break at my job. I worked for international paper as a mill chemist. I was on break and I opened up Romans 10:14, and something struck me as if I had never read this verse before, sort of thing. I'm sure this happens to you. It reads from Paul, "How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? How will they believe in him in whom they have not heard, and how will they hear without a preacher?" Now, I saw a rhetorical sequence here. It's in reverse. So what we begin with, the need of calling upon, we must begin with the preacher, a mode from which to receive that which we will deliberate upon. And then, required a hearing. Him who has ears, let him hear to understand what the preacher is delivering to us. Then the next in the sequence is the need to believe, to trust, to embrace, to value, to want, to lean upon, and lastly, to call on, to act upon that. Now, I know that this is referring specifically to the sharing of the gospel, how beautiful are the feet of them who brings good news out of Romans 10, but I couldn't let go of the broader context that this might be painting of a perspective of how my students in class are actually toiling through what I'm delivering in a lesson. So the quadrant perspective is what I finally came up to, and let me just introduce it, have it with my incredible artistic skill I apologize for, but it's at least good enough that you can see what I'm talking about. So this quadrant perspective is the way I put it. The student first needs to receive adequately. Milton in his Seven Laws says, hey, if the student is not attentive, you stop. So we have to determine ways to get it in, to get our lesson, our chemistry lesson, in so that their door is open. And I have some tricks to get them engaged. I'm sure you have some tricks to get them engaged. Maybe at the end I'll share some of those, even though they're not really what I'm after in this talk. Next, the hearing of it, to get it, to study it, to understand. Next, the wanting it, to believe part of the sequence, to be endeared to it, the love of learning. We can talk more about. And lastly, the lesson becomes them. They can do it. They can perform. They are have the ability to be the teacher. And then what I had just as a layout of the diagram, I'd call the upper soul more the cognitive side of what the student's wrestling. And then the lower part of the diagram would be more what the scripture would talk about, the cardia, the heart. More the endearment and the taking that which motivates me and to be able to express that. Now, what I found, if we begin with this first quadrant of how a student receives and has the door open, what are some of the prerequisites for a student to actually grab onto information and that need to get it in? And what I really was helped with was years ago, things started to click in my own understanding in some of my readings of Locke's Essay on Human Understanding. And what I realized, and again, we're coming at this from a different angle, is how the mind adequately receives data gives some inclinations towards the trivium. This grammar, logic, rhetoric, trivium just isn't to me something pulled out of the blue because it works. It's something to me that is hardwired in the way that my students are designed. So in some of Locke's wording, Locke said that you can't really begin to deliberate upon something unless it shows some level of distinction. A distinct perception of different objects. So, in order for students to really be able to grab hold of things, I'll contrast things like quantities. What's the difference between talking about a quantity using the number of them, the mole, or the mass? I contrast things. It helps the student to receive. What else helps a student to receive? Composition is what Locke said. It puts together several of those simple into a complex. So I talk about concentration, ratios, or the mass per volume, how the different parts fit together. Very rudimentary, but the student needs to see that. And Locke said thirdly, actually he said it secondly, but it makes more sense to put it third, is a matter of relation. It gets from their comparison one with the other. So I can compare the similarities between chemical concepts, molarity, normality, etc. So in order to really be able to, and I cannot receive something unless I see these, is what I would believe. I see this animal in the woods, you know, And immediately I distinguish it from the plants around it. And then immediately I notice its nose, its snout, its tail, its fur. And then immediately I start comparing it with other critters that are like it. And this is very passive. I'm not really working really hard. It just comes at me this way. And a student, I believe if you could exploit these things in your lessons to give distinction, to break things into their parts and to see how they're like, how they're different, how they're like one another. Martin Luther as well spoke of this sort of rhetorically as if, hey, you guys all know this. Do not your rhetoricians teach that he who undertakes to speak upon any subject ought first to show whether the thing exists, and then what it is, what its parts are, what it's contrary to, connected with, like unto it, etc. This was the given. This was from medieval times, the given. So we have a little picture of the first quadrant in order to receive, again, my incredible artistic accomplishments here. Someday I'm going to grow in being able to do this prettier, but you got it. About this distinction, to be able to separate objects and contrast them, the composition, to be able to talk about the parts of it, and then the relation, to be able to draw comparisons between. Very fundamental, very rudimentary, but it's a wonderful foundation from which to get more complex ideas from. If we go on to what I would term in my perspective, one of perhaps 100 perspectives of how we deliberate, but I think it's a strong one, data identification, to actually identify data, the need to get it, again from Locke, how the mind actively now identifies data. Now that it's come to me, now my student's mind has to go, has to achieve certain things in order to truly, in a full-orbed way, identify this data. Locke first talked about abstraction. He grouped this with the other three, but for me, this is more active. Now I'm working on it. He talked about the receiver establishing general representatives of all the same kind. Here you're beginning to group things together. Now you're tagging them with a name. Now I can say, it's a fox, this critter I saw in the woods. I can identify it. I can put it in my mind. I have a place in my mind. I've abstracted it. I've abstracted it under a genus. Now I know what it is. Before, the distinction, I knew that it was this and not that, but now I know what it is. I separate it out and put it in a category. This is what I would call my students' categorical thinking. It's their ability to retain information. Through the grammar years, they're getting very good at abstracting and retention and this categorical type of thinking. It's not that difficult, just a lot of memory work to be able to name all the different chemical laws that I need to know, all the puzzle pieces. Next is what I would call integration. It's what Locke talked about in annexing things together, an additional perception annexed to them. Now we're network building. We're saying that this fits with that. If I understand this puzzle piece and I understand that puzzle piece, how do they go together? In the last, Locke talked a lot about was causality. Receive this, their existence from the due application and operation of some other being. Whereas with abstraction, we're doing categorical thinking, having my students to have good retention so they can spit back little puzzle pieces that they've learned. Hey, you need the puzzle pieces before you build the puzzle. Integration, to be able now to do some problem solving and then take this what I know and that what I know and be able to put them together in the right solution pathway in a sequence, that's more integration. And then causality, big challenge for students. And it's something I'd love to hear when I give you some opportunity of maybe ways that you're helping your students think hypothetically, meaning that, okay, I know I'm getting good at problem solving, But now I'm thrown this predicament, this curve, something I've never seen before. Are you able to take your skills, the integration skills that you've been able to build, and now in a causal way, the if-then, that you can solve problems that are sort of out of the blue, don't seem related. In a way, I can abstract a stapler. I have this object on the desk. I distinguish it from the other objects on the desk. I see its parts. It has this hinge and a device and everything, and I relate it quickly to other hinge things, maybe like a hole punch. Okay, I'm receiving it, and then I can tag its stapler. I've abstracted it. I know its whatness. It's called its hexeity, its whatness, what it is. I put it under a category. And now I can integrate this. I know the stapler, and I have the staples, and I have paper, and it fits. It works. How does the stapler work? I can integrate it with the other parts that it's naturally inclined towards. And how about hypothetical thinking now? Did you know that I have fixed curtains with a stapler when my wife wasn't around? So I can take, now that I know how to use this stapler, I have a weapon that I can take into life with me, and I can apply it in ways that perhaps even my teacher never explained how I can apply it. Not only have I built a warehouse of abstractions, of memory, of retention, I have over the years gained skills in solution pathways, and I'm getting a knack for solving problems, and now I come into a kairos, a situation that seems totally foreign. Am I able to apply my faith to this situation? Am I able to apply my chemical mastery to this new situation? It's a big challenge. And I, again, I'll share a few things of what I'm, picking away at. But I would love to hear some of the things that some of you are doing. And I don't care if it's in chemistry or if it's in some other discipline that could be related. I think we could all help well. So really, this abstraction, integration, and causality is a very full-orbed way of what I call identifying the content, the cognitive effort. You think of identification as only talking about the knowledge that I can build, but it's really, if I really know what this thing is, it's more than what I'm calling knowledge. It's understanding. It's wisdom. It's a full orbed. Aristotle made this point out of his physics. For the point of our investigation is to acquire knowledge. Okay, is that just knowing facts about what this is called, what that's called, what this is called, what that's called? And a prerequisite for knowing anything is understanding why it is as it is, in other words, grasping its primary cause. Obviously, then, this is what we have to do in the case of coming to be, ceasing to be, natural change in general. Aristotle wrote a lot about change. There is a lot of debate over the nature of change. But regardless of some of his faults that people like Galileo improved upon, yet he at least realize that in order to fully know something, it was much more fully orbed. I can take a toddler out, point at a tree, and say, tree. And the toddler will point and say, tree. Okay, they know tree. And I know tree. There's a great difference between that knowledge and my knowledge. I know what the tree will do if it falls over, what the nature of its parts are, et cetera, et cetera. I'm knowing about the tree, and it's more full orbed, I said, than that. So we see a aim of the upper soul, a pursuit, the abstraction. The scripture talks about building this resource now of knowledge. It's like a repertoire that our students are building. Knowledge can puff up, love builds up. But yet knowledge in Proverbs is seen as something, a very valuable repertoire that our students must build. But all this knowing and not knowing how to apply it and integrate it with other bits of knowledge, if these puzzle pieces can't come together, what good is that? And if we can be good problem solvers and understand how these problems are meant to be solved, if we can't take that out into life, if it just stays in the classroom, if we can't throw a few curves at our students to see what they might be able to do, it's not as, again, full-orbed in the identifying of this knowledge that's existing in our students. So we can see, at least I could see, an interesting how we identify, even though it's more active, is somewhat derived from the principles by which we can adequately receive data. Something very static and set apart, something very compositional in how things fit, and then the drawing the lines of how this affects that and how this relates to that. I believe just those three principles are very fundamental. And I said all that just to talk a little bit about the trivium, because I believe that the trivium is more than just something that works. It's something that fits the way we are. We see a theological trivium. I just picked out two scriptures, but there are numerous scriptures that give these three ideas together. For the Lord gives wisdom, and from his mouth come knowledge and understanding in Proverbs. For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will, that whatness, and all spiritual wisdom to be able to use that in a causal manner. A wise person is someone who can look around the corner, can do the if-then, can look down the road and anticipate what might be coming. Unlike one of my sons who, mowing the lawn, mows over the garden hose 7 times. I mean, you just have to have that awareness of down the road a little bit. And understanding, to be able to fit and connect. The synesis is the Greek for understanding. It just means to fit together so that you may walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. And then we finally come to what I wanted to talk about. Do we have any time left? The classical trivium. Again, this knowledge, understanding, and wisdom is a beautiful development in Scripture that I believe the trivium mirrors. The knowledge or the whatness of data. This is the grammar, what it is. This is what I call categorical thinking. Are our students getting good at retention? Okay? Can you think about this a little bit? Because I want to look at each of these individually, maybe share a couple things that I do, but I would really like it if some of you could tell me, what are some ways that you are helping your students retain through the years what they're learning in chemistry class? I'd be very curious, and I got my pen right here for some ideas. Such good resources here. I have to take advantage of all of you. Understanding the connectedness, then, of data. The logic, then, is how things fit together, how things work, solution pathways that we can come up with, being a good problem solver. I want my students to be good dialectical thinking, dialectic thinkers, uncovering these capabilities, the dialectic of coming to a synthesis, the fighting back and forth and figuring out how things fit together properly. I want my students to be good categorical thinkers. I want them to retain what I'm telling them. How are some ways that I can help my students retain what I'm telling them? I want my students to be good dialectical thinkers. I want them to get the knack of how to fit things together to come to a resolution of a problem. And in wisdom, the ability to take this and causally impact my surroundings in a situation. And again, this to me is a good portion of the rhetoric of chemistry. What can I do with it? Formally, rhetoric is persuasive speaking, to be able to go out and impact a situation persuasively and move an audience towards your goal. And this, again, is what I would call hypothetical thinking, that you're able to extend these capabilities into the Greek kairos, the situation that you face. And it can be very challenging for my students. And sometimes these are the chemistry problems that I pose to them that create, I only give these to my honor students, but I try to stretch them. So let's get to chemistry finally. If I can just review real quickly, the grammar, again, the pieces of the puzzle, we teach them terminologies, principles, uniformities, equations. All these have to be put somehow and retained so that I can pull these out of my brain. So that I can pull these out of my brain in order to pursue what they're meant to pursue. I don't want my students to say, I know what this law is or that law is, and to impress you with what I know. Can you use those? Can you use the ability to use these principles to solve problems is the logic. And then the rhetoric are these implications of the puzzles, the ability, again, to extend logic and to anticipate situations. Love your input, but for me, this is a good picture of the grammar, the logic, and the rhetoric of chemistry. I go in other areas in the rhetoric as well in order to apply into situations what we've learned. So, let's talk a little bit more about chemistry grammar. The data abstraction. The ability, again, to think categorically. For retention, I assume that a lot of you are seeing the benefit of some type of review. Of that you teach concept A, and at some later point you're teaching concept B, but you don't let go of concept A. At some point you teach concept C, but you don't let go of concept B. And a little bit of concept A yet dangling around. The first or second day of chemistry class, I give them this question. Can you turn grams into moles and moles into grams using the periodic table? And just about every two or three days, I say the same thing. Can you change grams into moles and moles into grams using the periodic table? And you probably have other things that you have to continually dig back up and dig back up for your students until they can do it, proverbially with eyes closed sort of thing. Maybe you work with mnemonics as well. The BET, CPR, SOB. I make sure that I say SOB and not the letters, but they probably wouldn't know what I'm talking about. But I'm trying to help them use these devices to try to help with the grammar. And this is for the atomic model. The BET is a bending experiment, discovered electrons. That was Mr. Thompson. The collision experiment discovered the protons in the atom now. That was Mr. Rutherford. And spectral studies discovered orbitals. Who is that? Yeah, Mr. Bohr. And you can come up with other things. And I don't know if any of you have pursued, how can I get them with all this information, how can I help fool the mind to be able to recall? And maybe you can think of these things more toward the end when we have a little gap of time. But has anyone here had some means of helping their students with retention? Any thoughts, any comments in that? We'll come back because if I ask questions too quickly, you haven't had a chance to think through. But any thoughts? Yeah. And so the student ever says, I don't really have trouble remembering whatever it is. Right. I usually redirect them to someone in the class that says, well, let's make a jingle. Yeah. Because by the time they get to chemistry, they've gone through so much grammar. What Donna might be getting at is they have perhaps invented their own mnemonics, in order to know... you know, to help them retain. And that's the whole point, I believe, to think categorically, is to be able to bunch things somehow, to be able to put things together under some heading, even though they don't realize they're doing it. Sometimes the grammar of chemistry can be kind of daunting. Not as bad as biology is my estimation, but perhaps the logic and the rhetoric of chemistry might be more daunting. I'm really curious in this area, and I'm sorry if I'm peppering you, but this intradisciplinary effort is something at Schaefer Academy I'm trying to get going better. It's the vertical integration that helps build the student categorical thinking. And I think some of you are perhaps doing this well, is that you go across grade levels and you pass up so that the sixth grade teacher passes to the seventh grade and so on, so that when I'm teaching my students in chemistry, I have an idea of what chemistry they are bringing so I can save a lot of time and I don't need to reinvent the wheel. Some of you have done things like pass up. Can anyone else share what you're doing for vertical integration? Do you know what your fourth grade teacher is doing, or has any school made what you've seen as some successful efforts for that sort of integration? Or have you seen that as a problem, that you don't know what the lower grades are doing and you're wondering where your student is at walking into your class? Any thoughts there? It's a burden that I have. So I did have an example of what I'm working on, for example. So what I've been doing is going through the earlier grades. This is grade 6. And I go through the grade 6 science book that we're currently using, and I pick out what in chemistry I want them to follow with, that I want them to take with them. So I want that they've studied matter, atomic structure, they've learned the periodic table, states of matter, properties, and I can then... And their sixth grade teacher will show them this. I think there are more exotic ways of doing this. And they will become familiar. Okay, now this is what is going to be passed up to the next grade. This is some of the core things that you have now learned in sixth grade. And your seventh or eighth or ninth grade teachers are going to expect you to know this so you can anticipate. And then teachers know what the higher level teachers are going to be expecting. And I think that that's good. That's great for the grammar because, again, it's a means of review, and it's building upon instead of building something, letting the memory go and wipe it away, and then trying to build it again and letting it go and wiping away, etc. In chemistry logic, challenge here, the ability to think dialectically, to learn to solve problems, to come up with a sequence of problem solving that the students can get a knack for that. John Mays gave a great concept session and how he wants his students in his math classes to be able to solve. Another approach that I found helpful, this isn't the approach, just another tool in the arsenal, is what I'd call a teleotic approach, teleos meaning the end, the aim. There's a lot of times I tell my students, what is the end that I'm asking you to do? So in this case, I might tell the students, I have 5 grams, this is the stoichiometry, some of you do them, I have 5 grams of calcium phosphate. It reacts in a double replacement reaction with sulfuric acid. How many grams of phosphoric acid am I going to produce? And I give it to them in words, so they have some steps to do. They have to, their nomenclature, they have to know what calcium phosphate, what the formula for that is, and sulfuric acid. They have to do the double replacement and be able to write out the formulas right. Then they have to balance the reaction so they don't know the ratio of moles of this to moles of that. Okay, what's the telos? What's the goal now that you've accomplished what the reaction actually is? Oh, how many grams of the phosphoric acid? Okay, now what would you need to know to get to there? Well, I can know the moles, so I can know moles to grams. And so one way is to pursue it backwards. So sometimes in solving the logic, another skill is to concentrate on the end and then to see how I can get there and maybe even take steps backwards to get to where I started from. Some students won't do it that way. I just try to give that opportunity to them. So what's the target value, skills needed? Now, how can I take what I know and go to this unknown then? Any other thoughts on some of your skills and problems, struggles? I always want to give opportunity if someone has any comments in this area as well. Challenge for me again, something that I'm working on for logic, is interdisciplinary network. This is not a vertical, the pass-up between grades. It's a horizontal integration, helps build the student's dialectical thinking. Cross disciplines, more of a pass-across mentality, allow other disciplines to encroach into chemistry. There are some beautiful examples and fits, but you can pretty much fit anything. The zeroth law of thermodynamics, my students love that. What's that about? Zeroth law? And I talked to them about the hypothetical syllogism, so we can bring their logic training into the zeroth law of thermal equilibrium, so that if system A is in equilibrium with B and system C is in equilibrium with B, then they're in equilibrium with each other. And the hypothetical syllogism, if A then B, if B then C, then if A then C, so you can begin to draw in different other disciplines in and integrate them into what's happening in chemistry. Latin and Greek roots, a lot of history can be integrated in. Some of you are probably doing this much better than I am. But I just think it helps to learn a concept, if you can bring the issues of the ear, the concepts in. Who is it? Was it Mosley who died from a sniper bullet during World War I? And then the British decided from that point not to allow any of their scientists to go into active combat. You know, students really love those sorts of stories that bring science into the context of the historical era. Now, the real challenge is the chemistry rhetoric, ability for a student to think hypothetically, ability to respond to a curveball being thrown at you, ability to generate a hypothesis is very critical, especially with some of their science fair efforts, to be creative. I have done some essays to have them being able to express themselves well, like explaining the concept of pH to a friend. Well, that seems pretty simple, but you have to pull in a lot of different things. Soren Sorensen, Le Chatelier, the concept of logarithms, to be able to explain these concepts well. But even more challenging are some of the hypothetical problems. So, for example, the student, I know how to calculate percent by mass. I know how to change between moles and grams. But what if I'm thrown something different? Aluminum metals heated with an element from group 6A, the oxygen family. Periodic table, an ionic compound forms. When the experiment is performed with an unknown group 6A element, the product is that percent by mass of aluminum. What's the formula of the compound? So that at first glance, maybe some of you are doing this already on the logic basis as you've explained this through and the students getting used to these problems. But it's a neat challenge just to give them the rudimentary parts and then throw a problem like this, more of a but what if problem at them. Then they're handling the same problem in a rhetoric sort of principle manner, in that they have to think how to piece things together to get to an unknown. I understand acid-based neutralization, so I wonder about neutralizing capabilities of over-the-counter antacids. Again, you're thinking outside to what's in the store on the shelves of these different antacids, so you can apply hypothetically to them what you have learned in class. Some of the substances commonly used in stomach antacids are magnesium oxide, magnesium hydroxide, aluminum hydroxide. Write a balance reaction. Which of these substances will neutralize the greatest amount of that concentration of hydrochloric per gram? Those are some of the thoughts I have as far as hypothetical questions as well. I don't know if you have any things that you're doing as far as some of the struggles that you're helping your students with, some of your problem solving, that this is what I've been doing. I've been doing things perhaps identical to what a lot of you are doing in your chemistry and other science classes, but I'm trying to be really overt in understanding how the student is thinking, and maybe you're doing this too, I use, here's the grammar, okay, here's some logic. Okay, how about some rhetorical, hypothetical thinking skills? See if you can take this problem. So for my honor students, I will give them hypothetical questions and see how well they can do, et cetera. That's pretty much what I wanted to share, some of the principles and what I'm doing in chemistry class to try to exploit this methodology called the trivium. And I don't know if possibly you have comments or questions from all of you. I did have one other little thing that I could share on the side, but just wanted to know if anyone had anything, questions or whatnot. Or else we can go to lunch a little early. Yes. Right.
Passing it to grammar students who were prepared for logic science. So we created a grid of, for example, in chemistry, all the different science disciplines. So we created a grid where in each of the disciplines going across with, for example, sixth grade, showing all of the objectives so that even the logic school teacher was able to see and say, yes, they will be ready when they come.
Right. Right. You see, I'm gonna, in trying to develop this better, I need to be a good marketing agent to our elementary teachers, that I'm not imposing something more upon them, but I'm actually allowing an opportunity for them, once they are able to communicate with those particularly beneath them grade-wise, you're going to save a lot of time because you're not reteaching. So I think it's something that if I keep pursuing, I think the dividends will be very good.
I went to my advanced biology teacher and asked him what concept do they not remember that you need them to remember?
Yes.
It's every law. I'm having to reteach one.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, I like that. You're writing a letter to the future. It's almost like a time capsule thing that you can, yeah. Right. See, that's what I'm looking for. Just a way of vertical integration was so not only time-saving in our teaching efforts, but it also helps a student with categorical thinking to be able to retain, because they've seen the core of what they should know, and they know what's going to be expected, and they aren't as willing to just let that go. And we can build a foundation rather than reteaching. Yes. Right.
In other words, that you know, I've taught and
we're going to
hear again.
Right.
Even though we've
got a lot of right. You see, for us, that's excellent. In eighth grade, we have physical earth science. Ninth grade is biology, and 10th grade is chemistry. So it would be neat even in, and then 11th grade physics. It would be neat even in 10th grade chemistry, 9th grade biology, 10th grade chemistry, if there could somehow, and we aren't there, be portions that could still talk about chemistry and physics so that I teach some physics in 8th grade and they don't hear it again till 11th grade, and just to build some sort of, again, intradisciplinary continuity, I think would be very helpful. It's just that challenge to be able to orchestrate that. I think the teachers have to have that in their heart, that they want to see the full orb nature of God's creation, and they don't want to divorce physics from their biology class. Some way to integrate that. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have different disciplines within the grade. You're separate.
Uh-huh.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Now, this is fourth grade, you said? Now, from what you've taught in fourth grade, would a seventh grader be able to glean some of that? I mean, I'm just talking retention here and some of the means that some of you have had so that what's being taught in fourth grade can still somehow be grabbed by a student by seventh grade. Uh-huh. Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah. See, one of the problems of what we have at Schaefer is that we teach biology in ninth grade, and then we have not yet figured out how to staff to get anatomy and physiology going in 12th grade or 11th grade or something like that. So we're working on it, you know? Yeah. Review games from what they've learned previous grades or just previous chips? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So one thing that I see here is if our students can't do well in what I'm calling categorical thinking, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot if we really want to make the easy transition in those dialectic logic grades to their mastery of problem-solving skills, because they don't have the language secure in them to be able to use that to start pulling from those to build a solution pathway to the solution to a problem. Yes. Yes.
And they have to remember five of those after each major test we have.
Yeah.
But if, they hate those.
Yeah.
But if you follow them, you're going to get biology that's going to have
right, right.
It helps
and the Latin and Greek roots, I think, is a natural, good, cohesive way to bridge things together. I'm horrible. I just go in a dictionary and I'm teaching this word and I look up the etymology and then we talk about that. It's not very formal what I do yet, but I do emphasize Latin and Hebrew and Greek. So, any other comments? Any other thoughts? Yes. Yeah. Well, your school has some objectives for each grade. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think different states also, the state of Minnesota has their requirements, and it's not what I go with, but it's a good resource for what they think, and I say nah or yeah or things like that. But I don't know. Do you know? I'm sorry, what did you say? Real science for kids? Mm-hmm. Let me just share one more thing, if I can get there quickly, sorry. In order to grab students, one thing that I found is helpful, and maybe you have your own trick. Again, we're back to the first quadrant and being able to get my students to look at me and get interested. And it's what I've kind of put together as a Shaq attack kind of thing, the Shaq O'Neal, S-H-A-Q. Again, these are my little mnemonic devices that I even have to use for myself. In that, to start off a lesson, I will... maybe tell a story of something what happened to me. I've been in labs all my life in industry and environmental. I've seen enough things blow up that I can tell some really good stories. And hypothetical is a what if. Yeah, what if this would happen or what if that? And sometimes they enjoy that. Analogy is what like. I think a real good teacher is the one who can use these tropes and analogies in order to grab students' attention. And I like to ask students, what are some of the things that's happened to you? For an example, if I teach about solution concentration, a story, I've heard of a hospital patient being accidentally killed by a decimal place. And you've probably heard that too, that accidentally the nurse puts in milligrams instead of micrograms or something of the intravenous dose. And so it's very important for measuring concentration. Hypothetically, what would happen if you added 1 grain of salt to a second to a cup of water, just to have them understand saturation and to think about another grain, dissolve another grain. Eventually it's not going to dissolve. Eventually, you're going to have this huge pile of damp salt. So just this continuum, analogously, an analogy, there are 50 explosive devices in the basement. Is that dangerous? And of course they'd say yes, but what if they are little caps? And it's different than TNT, so I use that to teach the concept of normality. A molarity is a concept of concentration that just tells you how many are there. Normality tells you their potency of how many are there. And then question, how's the concentration of liquid products in the store labeled? As you don't get much response to that because they don't really notice those, but maybe you can think of different what you have come across. So, and this is what I'm looking for, just little helps to help my class, help my students learn. So, any other remaining points, or we might be able to finish a few minutes early, I think, off to lunch. Okay, well, thank you.